Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and we're going to be talking about, obviously, because I live in the Pacific Northwest, one of the most gorgeous areas in the country. Am I biased? You bet. And my guest today, William Sullivan, lives in a section of the Pacific Northwest, which is in the state of Oregon. And we're going to be talking about his personal experience of actually building a cabin, and the story is just captivating. It really is. It's called Cabin Fever, Notes from a Part-Time Pioneer, and I want to welcome William Sullivan to the show. Hello, William.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's a delight. Are you getting flooded down in Oregon the way we are up here in Washington?
A little bit. I'm a little worried about this cabin. We only live there in the summers because it's in the coastal rainforest.
Uh-huh.
And it gets 100 inches of rain in the winter. So
I
the river
know.
Can flood there and make it impossible to get in and out.
It's
a pretty wild place.
It really is, and your story is so absolutely wonderful. Now, I want my audience to know a little bit about you. You are a publisher yourself, and I had the chance to meet you at the Book Expo that was going on here in Tacoma. And you're quite accomplished. You've done a lot of publishing of so many books relating to the Pacific Northwest, especially Oregon.
Yeah, I've done 17. I've actually written 17 books, and I'd say, five or seven of them are hiking and travel guides. And for them, I had to actually hike every trail I could find in Oregon, which is a big state, so this was a lot of exploration. And then I've done two adventure memoirs, including Cabin Fever, a couple of books about history in the Northwest, and four novels now, too.
What I found so charming, and I know you've got one about D.B. Cooper.
Also, yeah, my latest
we'll
is a thriller.
We'll touch on that. Yeah, we'll touch on that later. But this Cabin Fever, I've known people in Alaska and in the Pacific Northwest, but especially in Alaska. Well, when you say cabin fever, it's when people are going bananas mentally and because of being locked up during a winter period. But your story about cabin fever is just so charming. And, I mean, it really, you really tell it as it is because this was property that your family owned. And like you said, it's in the rainforest, and you get all of this water. You have true stories. You even have a mystery, a murder mystery that has been somewhat solved over a period of years. But this, I think, is such a wonderful saga. It's a saga about family. It is a story about you and your wife when you were first married and how you take on this project. And it's something I think if people read to go, wow, would I have been able to do that? When you look back on it, did you think that you and your wife had a temporary case of insanity, or did you?
Well, I think it's part of the American psyche. It's partly, you know, go west and freedom and independence and build your own house by hand out mm-hmm. in the woods. But you're right, there's this other side to it, too. That when you do that, you're kind of all alone out there, and so that can be a little scary at times, too.
Now,
and in our case, this was the late 1970s, and I was writing for the Mother Earth News, and everybody at this time wanted to go back to nature and live off the land, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And my parents had this remote property that they'd bought kind of as a bad investment. there's no road to it. This is on a river in the Coast Range that has no road, so you have to walk in a mile and a half to get to the site. And my wife and I said, well, you can't think of anything to do with it. We'll build a log cabin there. And since we were broke, we said, well, we'll do it by hand, the Pioneer way, with nothing but a crosscut saw and an axe. So it only cost $400 to build this cabin. And it didn't take us too long to realize why my parents got this property so cheap. And it wasn't just the lack of a road. It turned out that the previous homesteader had been murdered there. And there was a ghost story, and no one wanted the place. So as we're building the cabin, we decide we'd better interview the neighbors and try to guess which one of them did it. You want to know who your murderer is in the neighborhood.
Oh, absolutely, because you don't want anybody sneaking up on you. The people that were around you, of course, this wasn't a heavily populated area at all.
No, but there's only about half a dozen families in this whole valley.
Right.
And it turns out every one of them had a motive to kill the old, our predecessor there. So every one of them was a suspect. We started interviewing, and we kept lists of clues and motives, and they all claimed they knew who had killed him, but they all pointed at someone else.
Now, in the book, right at the beginning, you show your very simple drawing of a log cabin. And I have, through the years, often wondered why in the world anybody would ever want a log cabin. Because log cabins, yes, I know Abe Lincoln lived in one, but they weren't the best structures in the world. And here you were in an area, as you said, you had to hike in a mile and a half, no road. So you had to hike into this area. And the very beginning for you and your wife, and of course you were quite young at the time, but both of you had to haul rocks so that you even could build a place to set up a fire. And I was so surprised when in the story your wife said, well, we can't use these kinds of rocks. We have to use another kind of rock. And you didn't even think of that. And she had enough education and background where she said, if you use a certain kind of rock, it's going to crack and it's going to cause problems because of the heat of the fire. So you guys had to go off a distance and pull in these rocks that weren't going to crack under heat so that you could have something to cook with. You were really in a pretty primitive environment.
Yeah, for the first two summers. And this was a summer thing. The first two summers, we lived in a tent and with a lot of rain and all of that. And one of the first things we had to do was to haul rocks because they weren't very close by, but not just for the fire, but also for the foundations. Because if you're building a log cabin in a rainforest, you can't put the logs on the ground. They'll just rot. So we had to build piers 18 inches high. So the first logs were a foot and a half off the ground, so they wouldn't rot. Mm-hmm. And that has worked all these years. But so the cabin is built up on piers. And that's something we learned from the Norwegians. Now, my wife's ancestry is all Scandinavian, and we'd gone there and visited there. And there are a lot of log cabins in Norway. And they're all built up off the ground because to get away from the rot. And we modeled our cabin after a Norwegian-style log cabin with big eaves to shed the rain and then high foundations to keep it dry. And that did work.
Yes, it did work. And I've learned so many things, like your mom saying that you stuff the logs with moss, because whenever you're using logs, they're always irregular. And I don't care if you try to plane them down until they're smooth as silk. Doesn't make any difference. You're going to have gaps in there. And so she said, well, the old-timers in the Yukon used moss. Well, that brought in its own problems. But, you use that for insulation. But there was a huge learning curve with this. But I was so surprised when I'm reading along to find out that your mom and dad actually came out. And your dad was writing a column for an Oregon newspaper, And he would tell the story of his experiences of being out and working with you on this. This really ended up becoming a family project. And there's no television out here. There's nothing to distract you from what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. The book itself covers 25 summers. So the story arc is most of our marriage. And we start out young kids, and we build this. Our first room of the cabin is a small cabin. It's only 10 by 12 feet. That's all the bigger it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes two summers because we had never cut down a tree before. We're babes in the woods, and here we're up there in the woods cutting down trees with a cross-cut saw and have to haul them down to the site and put them up and bark them and flatten them and put moss in between the logs, as you say. And then after a couple of years, our kids were born, and we realized we needed a bigger house. So then we added on another room with an upstairs and a spiral staircase, and that took more years to do. And over the years, then, the kids grew up there in the summers. And imagine, kids growing up today with no video games, no soda pop, no television,
mm-hmm.
It turns out they're okay. They learn to read books, catch frogs, climb trees. Basically, loved it. They still do. It's
yes,
possible to grow up that way and be okay.
Well, that's the way a lot of people grew up, and they were perfectly fine, and they learned how to be resourceful. I really had to chuckle at George, your neighbor, who was a farmer, and the episodes with the cows that you had. Now, some people, when they're hearing this, they say, oh, please, Donna, cows, you've got to be kidding. But really, you were out in the boonies, and there was so much history and personality to the environment that you were in. You had black bears, you had some real interesting critters, you had beaver, all kinds of birds, all kinds of things in your environment, even including skunk cabbage. And I didn't know that that was in Oregon. I knew it was up in Alaska. You'll find skunk cabbage, which really stinks. And it can be huge up in the rainforest of Ketchikan. And it might be in some other areas of Alaska, but I do know about Ketchikan and skunk cabbage. But I had no idea that it was down in Oregon. Your neighbor, George, and his sons, Joe and Jack, talk about them because they were really interesting characters.
Well, they're dairy farmers, and I don't know if you know Tillamook cheese. It's a famous cheese kind
mm-hmm.
of, right? It's made out of Oregon. Well, they're of old Finnish stock. Their grandfather came here from Finland in the early 1900s and homesteaded out there. And a lot of the old families in that area are old Finnish dairy farmers. So they kept on that tradition. And we lived across the river from them. And we have 30 acres of forest and 25 acres of pasture. What can you do with the pasture? Well, we rented it out to them for their dairy cattle.
Mm-hmm.
But so they couldn't have their regular cattle there because they couldn't bring them back to milk them. So they would send their heifers over. These are the young cows, only 1 or 2 years old. They haven't had a calf yet and don't need to be milked. And to get them over, they would swim them across the river at the start of the summer and then leave them all summer over there and get them fat, and once they have a calf, bring them back and start milking them. So for years we did that.
Mm-hmm.
And they've retired now, and that pasture has now become an elk pasture.
Oh, my heaven.
30 head of elk that wander in there at night and graze around. They're very shy and huge. They're bigger than the cows were. But pasture is still being used.
That is just amazing. Nature is so resilient. It's something that your wife mentions in the story, and it's true. Now, in today's world, would you be allowed to build a cabin as you were allowed to do in the way and manner that you did it many years ago? Because eventually a tax assessor came out. You yeah. cannot seem to avoid these people. They come out. But there were so few individuals in this area. And you were in a floodplain area, weren't you?
Well, we built it, we thought, pretty high, but there are no dams on this river. So we're a quarter mile away from the river and 26 feet above it. But one year, the river did flood up, and we got a foot and a half of water in the cabin. In a lot of houses, that would destroy the place. But a log cabin's actually, what do? You scrape out the mud, and you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it gets high enough to float it away, that's not an issue. And then in terms of the permits, well, we went and applied for a permit for this cabin back in 1977 when we started, and they, believe you me, the building permit people at the county just scratched their heads. They had no rules for log cabin construction, and they certainly didn't want to send an inspector out by boat or hike him in a mile and a half to come look at the place. So they basically gave us a permit and told us to go jump in a lake. Go, just
mm-hmm.
don't call them. So we are on the tax rolls. We're law-abiding citizens out there, but it is pretty remote.
Now, I wanted to ask you, did your wife do the illustrations in the book? You've got the illustrations of the cabin and the skunk cabbage and the thistles, which, very interestingly, have to be kept back because they actually can cause problems for cows. Do you still try to keep the thistles under control?
Well, if you don't have the cattle in the field, but instead have elk, the thistles aren't a problem because the elk like thistles a lot better than the cows do. So, no, it's not an issue anymore for the thistles. But the drawings in the book are by my wife, and it seemed more appropriate for a book like this to have pen and ink drawings than photographs.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you can see some of these on my website if you want to see some of the drawings or actually read a couple of sample chapters of the book. Go to OregonHiking.com, and you can see some of my wife's pen and ink drawings and some of the stories from the book.
Now, your lovely wife's name is Janelle,
mm-hmm.
and her art is really very, very nice. And you have so many interesting characters that are in your book. You have the butcher, who ends up actually getting shot at one point, and we won't go into too much detail on that, but he really was a butcher. He would come out to the dairy farm, and he had this huge vehicle, which is very common in today's world, and the butcher will take their vehicle because they can keep the sanitation regulations very much under control, and they will butcher steers or sheep or whatever someone may have that it's time for them to, you know, to kill the animal and then to prepare the meat so someone can use it. And it saves the rancher, the farmer, the sheep herder a lot of work. And he was quite a character. He just popped up in your environment all of a sudden.
Yeah, actually, he's Native American, and there are this is a long tradition in this area, too. This part of the Oregon Coast Range was originally the Siletz Indian Reservation. And still, the tribe has a sort of a cultural claim on this whole area. And so the butcher is actually as a sort of a shell-shocked Vietnam vet, but he... so when he pops up wearing camouflage fatigues and at night... and announces that he's the butcher, you kind of think, God, this is out of a horror movie. Because
mm-hmm.
it turns out he really is a butcher and maybe has some issues and a little bit of a claim on the land as well. There are, the tribe has legends about the demigods that ruled this area. And we're actually... violent and volatile, and perhaps they're still out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's a kind of a mystery, too.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about the demigods or the Indians?
The Indians are definitely still there. They're definitely still there, but who knows about the demigods? These would be the Skookums. Skookum is the Native American word for powerful, and the Skookum sisters were three immortal beings that create all kinds of mischief and haunt the woods. And you don't necessarily want your little kids to hear these stories late at night when they're out in a cabin in the woods. Because there's already enough trouble because of the old homesteader having been murdered there, and they start to imagine they see a guy walking through the woods at night with that eyeball hanging out and a pitchfork in his hand. And this is, you don't want your kids to come home with stories like that. So,
well, you had a tradition in your family. I think it was the summer solstice.
Yeah.
Where you'd have a big campfire, and of course your mom and dad were there, and then there came a point when your brother came out. But there was this telling of a ghost story, and your kids loved it. Absolutely loved the tradition, and every year, whatever you and your wife found out about, that was all blended in with this stuff. And I got such a kick out of it because you were very concerned. One incident with your brother when there was ghost story was really getting pretty raunchy. And you thought the kids would be affected, and the only thing you got was a comment from one of the boys, you should have put a bunny in the story. And I just laughed. I thought that was a hoot. You just never know how kids are going to respond.
Well, kids do like ghost stories. They don't mind being scared a little bit.
That's true.
That's a real common American tradition, too, is to sit around a campfire and scare yourselves a little bit. In this case, though, you have real ghost stories and real murders that sort of add an element to the ghost story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, you also were on the property. It was during the summer, and I remember the day very vividly, and that was the day that Mount St. Helens blew. We were living in Fife, and we actually saw the plume, and it was such a clear day, it didn't stay clear for very long. And you were in this location in Oregon, 150 miles away from it, and it sounded like an atomic boom, which really it is.
Yeah.
It's just incredibly powerful. And you went over to the dairy farm, and they had a television. And you were able to see all of the information, but you felt the power of that eruption, and you tell that story in Cabin Fever.
Yeah, when Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980, it blasted 14 cubic kilometers of the mountain into the sky, the whole top half of the mountain. And ironically, people in Portland and fairly near the mountain didn't hear that eruption, because the sound went up and then bounced off the atmosphere and came down. And people heard it farther away, as far away as Montana and Northern California. Mm-hmm. And where we were, 150 miles away, we heard several booms. It went boom, 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 and then kaboom! It just shook the ground. The birds flew out of the trees. The cattle stampeded across the pasture. We looked at each other and had no idea in this remote valley what could create that kind of a noise except World War III.
Mm-hmm.
So we rode over to find out the news from the neighbors, and my father, of course, was the editor of the newspaper in Salem at the time, and when he saw that the mountain had blown up, he was missing the news story of the century and wanted to get back to work.
Absolutely. I love the personality of the people that were in this environment that you and your wife dedicated so many of your summers to, as you said, 25. During one of those summers, you decided to go and meet a woman by the name of Mrs. Nelson. Now, she was of such hardy constitution. She was a widow, and she would climb up on the roof, do her own roof repairs. She just was an incredible woman, and she was, what, 83, 85 when you met her?
Yeah, she was in her 90s. She was still repairing the roof on her barn and milking her cow and doing all the, running the whole farm by herself.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. And she even took in the rambunctious teenagers that her other family members didn't know what to do with, so they'd send them out to Mrs. Nelson's place. And the stories of the kids that she dealt with, really, they, in a way, they're humorous, but they're not humorous, but they leveled out by the time they spent some time with her.
Yeah, you get these spoiled kids from, well, in her case, a lot of them were from Southern California. You'd grown up in cities and were used to, well, not just soda pop and video games, but fast cars and drugs and basically not working and getting up late and a lot of problems. And they were sassy. And so the parents would send them to grandma or great-grandma, often in this case, and put them on this farm, where there were no cars, no city, no television, nothing but work and good food. And you, Mrs. Nelson was not a woman that you could fight very successfully. Even a sassy kid couldn't stand up to her. So she'd straighten them out, put them to work, get them up in the morning, and feed them healthy food, and after a summer, they'd come back to the city, I think, with a clearer sense of reality. And I think we did that, too, because, you know, we'd grown up in the city, and those summers spent out there still are a good way to center, to focus on what's important, because you're living with nature on a natural rhythm. And you don't have to think, oh, I better go exercise today, because you're going to exercise in chopping the wood and hauling the water. And so there's a, I think it can straighten out more than just sassy teenagers. It can straighten all of us out to live that way a while.
I think it's a big dose of reality, but there's the story about the mama mouse and her babies, and just, I mean, there are, and the children, the stories of your children, your nieces, your nephews, how they responded to things. It really is a taste of reality that I think so many times when you live in the city and you have all of this electronic paraphernalia, you forget about the fact that there is a real world that exists in nature. And I think your story, Cabin Fever, is just a fabulous read. Now, we've got a couple of minutes before we're going to close out, and I wanted to bring up your book on D.B. Cooper.
Sure.
And D.B. Cooper, as we all know, was this individual that stole a whole bunch of money, jumped out of a plane. Nobody ever really found the money, found the plane, found him. And there are so many legends that came up. And you've got the case of D.B. Cooper's parachute. Now, you've written a novel, and you live in the area. Why did you decide to tackle D.B. Cooper?
Well, he is kind of became a folk hero, sort of like Jesse James or Robin Hood or something. This is a guy who was the very first skyjacker, the very first person to hijack an airplane. No one had ever thought of this before. And he asked for $200,000 and four parachutes. And so they landed and gave him that and then took off again. And he told them to fly toward Mexico, but very slowly as they could, with all the flaps down, just below 10,000 feet, with the cabin depressurized. And they had no idea why he'd do this, but he put on one of the parachutes, lowered the back door to the airplane. In those days, the Boeing 727s had a back door, and jumped out, and no one has ever found him. Some of the money, $5,000 of the money, did turn up in a river on a riverbank of the Columbia River, which suggests that he survived, but where's the rest of the money? Where is he? He's kind of bipolar. On one hand, he's the first terrorist. Hijacked a plane, threatened to blow it up. On the other hand, everybody was rooting for him because he didn't hurt anybody. he stole money from an airline company that everybody hated, and he got away. And it's sort of, sometimes you want the swashbuckling bandit to escape.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are D.B. Cooper parties and taverns and festivals all over the Northwest and the country, really, celebrating this bandit. Well, mm-hmm. there's never been a novel written about it before, and there's not that much known about the case because he didn't leave that many clues. So I thought it was time to pick up the story and tell what might have happened.
Well, I love the photos of you and your family, including your children, that are on the cover, the back cover of your book, Cabin Fever. The story is marvelous. It's absolutely marvelous. And then your case of D.B. Cooper's parachute, well, hey, we're in the cold, dark months. It's a great read. It's something to curl up with and maybe even read out loud to friends. But check out William L. Sullivan's work. You can go to his website, OregonHiking.com. That's correct, isn't it?
Yeah, OregonHiking.com. That's because I do a lot of hiking and am in Oregon, so why not
right.
Oregon Hiking?
And I think you will be intrigued by the material that he's put together. But again, Cabin Fever, it will take you back to a lot of what was done, really, by early pioneers. And how William and his wife, Janelle, spent 25 summers building this place into a summer home. And the adventures and the murder, well, you're going to have to read the book to find out what they found out. And was there a guilty party? Of course there was a guilty party, but who was it? Well, again, you're going to have to read Cabin Fever to find out. Check out OregonHiking.com for more information. William Sullivan, thank you for being my guest. It's been a joy.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you. We offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Now, telephone lines are open, and if you'd like to give me a buzz, 888-627-6008 is the telephone number to call into. That's 888-627-6008. Well, I wanted to share something with you, this being Thanksgiving week. A story by Faye Shannon. She lives in Lake Havasu in Arizona. She's talking about her dad. She said her dad, she always named Mr. Chatty. Whenever he would go for an appointment at his VA hospital, she said, you would have thought, and I quote her, he signed up for a shift as a greeter, not for a blood test. Such was his gift for gab. Now, she was a military brat. She said she just had moved so many times in her life, as so many times families in the military have to do. And she said, I really didn't mind being a child of a military person, but when you're the new gal in town, every time you move, you've got to reacquaint yourself with new people. she said, I really would copy my dad. My dad believed that whenever you're feeling sort of down, or you're feeling like life isn't fair, or you're an outsider, that all it takes is a smile, a hello, and chatting with someone. The gift, the gab that her dad utilized really taught her a lot. She said one person she had met was in his 80s, and she happened to be at the grocery store when she met him. She was feeling so absolutely exhausted, and he's in his 80s. She's like in her 30s. She's feeling old? Okay, you know she was having a bad hair day. And she starts chatting with this elderly gentleman. And do you know what? By the time they had finished their conversation, he had convinced her that age was just a number. It had nothing to do with anything else. She said one time she's dropping off donations at the Goodwill in her area. She started to chat with one of the workers. She finds out that he's planning to visit his daughter in Wisconsin. And she said, I don't know who got more excited about the trip, him or me, by the time we finished chatting. And she said, then there was a cashier at a gas station. Every time when she stops in for gas, they always chit-chat. And she always picks up an iced tea, one of those bottled iced teas. So that creates a conversation. And the employee will say, well, see you tomorrow, same time, same place. She said, I feel like I'm at home. And she said, sometimes the strangers I meet are the best part of my day. She said, it shows you that strangers really are just friends you haven't met yet. And I tell people that I absolutely love my post office. And the reason I do, and we have this little post office in my neighborhood, and we have some big ones that are, you know, a couple of miles away. But this one's really convenient. And we've gotten to know some of the people in there. And whenever we go in, it's like what you see in the Hallmark movies, people having conversation. And we talk about the kids, and we talk about various things. And we'll end up having conversations. I've written stories about conversations. That's The Miracle of Eight Pennies that I wrote. I mean, you're standing in line. You have conversations with people. It's marvelous. And I think sometimes we forget that everyone has a story to share. Everyone has a story to tell. And sometimes we get so much into our heads, we get so intellectual, that we forget what it's like just to chat. You don't have to be super intelligent, but just people talking with people. You know, my guest today, William Sullivan, when he was talking about his family, and Cabin Fever is just a marvelous read, and when you're dealing with the kids, the stories that the kids would come up with, or the conversations that would be enacted with the cows or the people that lived in their environment, this is real life. And it's amazing how we have gotten away from that. And that's why I encourage people. I said, go and walk around your neighborhood. I've had conversations with neighbors about apple trees, about growing squash in the ground, or there might be a small conversation about politics, believe me, small, and just anything and everything. And what happens, there is a camaraderie that evolves. We have new neighbors. They're a young couple. They've got a brand new baby, and grandma is living with them for a while, and we stand out there and we have conversations. My husband will talk with them. It's communication. It's a feeling that you have a connection. And I think so many times there's such an isolationist approach, and it's so easy to do. When you're sitting in front of a television, you're in a car going from point A to point B, to take that time just to talk with people and picking up the phone. I know we're all into email and other things like that, but take the time. When you're in the grocery store, smile at somebody and say good morning, maybe make a comment about things. There's just a conversation that goes on. And you might be amazed at what people have to share. And more than anything else, this is Thanksgiving week. We need to be grateful for so many of the things that we have around us in our lives. be grateful for the fact that we are able to communicate with other people, that we do have a technology that allows us to reach out to others. But I'll tell you something. I don't care who you are, where you are. The sound of the human voice and the caring and the compassion and the sharing really makes a difference. And I've yet to find an email that's been able to do that. So keep in touch with your friends. If you're thinking of relatives and you can't be with them, pick up the telephone, call, say hello. Just take that time. It makes a difference. Because in some instances, some of your friends may be older and they might not be around after a while. So take your time to communicate and to remember those that you love and be grateful for everything that you have, because it really is important. And Faye, thanks for sharing your story. I think it's a marvelous one. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. 888-627-6008. Now, tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Blanca de la Rosa. This is a woman from South America. Oh, my goodness. Did she break through glass ceilings? What an incredible woman. Her book is Empower Yourself, and this is a phenomenal read for anyone, male or female, but especially if you have young women who are saying, I don't know whether I should go to college, I don't know if I should do this, that, or the other. They need to know investing in themselves with their education and being willing to step out and get past their own fears is really important. Like I said, guys can benefit from this too. But you're not going to want to miss it. On Thanksgiving, we are going to be doing the Best of Donna. I am going to be with family and friends. On Friday, we are going to be discussing something that I don't think you've ever heard on anybody else's program. And what that is, Afghanistan. Now, I'm not talking about the political stuff or the war. I am talking about a man by the name of Atta that we are going to be interviewing. He's written a book called Lost Decency. He is an Afghan, and he's going to be telling us the real truth about the Afghan people and why things have evolved as they have. So I think you're going to find this a different perspective than what you have heard in typical programming. So all of that and more. And remember, if you want to check up on any of the guests that are coming up right here on BBS, you will find that there is a listing of the guests that are coming on the show with me, and also just a thumbnail sketch of what we're going to be talking about. So check that out if you like. And you can also go to my website, DelphiInternational.com, and check out the information there. Well, there was a story that I wanted to share with you, and it's about a young man. And he had gotten a very, very bad, an unpleasant rejection letter from a poetry editor of, at that time, a very popular publication called The Atlantic Monthly. Now, this individual was 28 years of age, and the note that was sent to him, one of the sentences said, "Our magazine has no room for your vigorous verse." But that didn't deter him. Robert Frost, a very, very famous poet known around the world, didn't give up on his work and didn't give up on his dream. Now, that was in 1902. Also, a physics student who had written a dissertation was called fanciful. Your ideas are irrelevant. He was turned down. He wanted to get his PhD. He had gotten his master's in. They read his dissertation, thought it was absolutely ridiculous and frivolous and whatever other word you want to use, turned him down. But guess what? That rejection didn't stop this individual either. That rejection ended up actually spurring him on. Albert Einstein was that man. It was the University of Bern that turned him down. And then there was a teacher at a college in England who sent home a report card about a man saying, a conspicuous lack of success. Basically, this person will never amount to anything. He became one of the most famous speakers of the 20th century, Winston Churchill. Now, these are names that we can easily recognize, but there are so many people in this world who, because they have been rejected, withdraw, and feel like they can never amount to anything. And I can remember times when I was given a label, when I was told that, no, you can never do this, you can never do that, you can never do the other. You know, I was told it wasn't going to be possible for me to do the radio show that I'm doing. 11 years later, I'm doing it, and this show is heard around the world. Rejection, we all need it. We can't go through life without having it. The key is, how are you going to utilize that rejection? What is it that you are going to leverage out of the rejection? Will you make yourself, shall I say, stubborn and obstinate, saying, I don't know how this is going to work out, but this is my passion, this is what I want to do, and this is what I'm going to do? Remember, you are the person, you're the only person that can really get things done. You're the one that if you have an idea, you have a concept, understand you may develop it in a way you would never have imagined. In a million years, I didn't really ever imagine that my passion for doing a show would create me being heard around the world on something called the Internet. But it is. You never know how it's going to be. So believe in yourself. Explore your options. And realize that those options are something there that are meant for you to reach out for. And you may end up being someone in your own right, a Winston Churchill, an Albert Einstein, or a Bill Gates, Steve Jobs. You just don't know. But have fun while you're doing it, too. Enjoy the process. Enjoy stretching yourself. It's a good thing. Donna Sebo, take a break, and we're going to come back. I'm going to give you a recipe for cooking turkey breasts that I think you will really like. This is brining them in apple juice, not salt water, but apple juice. And I think it will create a flavor that you will find really interesting. I know the Big Bird Day is just, well, a little bit around the corner. Stay with me. We'll be right back.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com, that's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. All I need from you is your first name or your initial, and it would be my pleasure to give you intuitive insights into what's happening in your life. 888-627-6008. If you enjoy Star Trek, teleportation, all of these fascinating concepts that one day are actually going to be real, I believe anyway, I think you'll find this story fascinating. We're going to be taking a voyage in the mind back into a time in history. Let's try 1593, October 24th. Now, this is actually a recorded incident. Gil Perez belonged to the Filipino Guardia Civil. He reported for sentry duty in Manila, in the Philippines, and he was teleported to Zocalo in Mexico City. That's nearly 9,000 miles away. Now, he drew a lot of attention because the uniform that he was wearing was spectacular. Totally unlike the dress of any of the local people. And he was carrying a very unusual musket, and he seemed confused. Well, I guess I'd feel the same way if I were in his situation. Now, they took him and took him to see the Mexican viceroy and his council. And at that time, there were officers of the Inquisition. Now, Perez, when they were questioning him, said that just a few moments before he found himself in Mexico City, he was reporting to the Malacanang Palace in the Philippines. He said the Philippine governor, Don Gomez Perez Dasmarinas, had been assassinated by an axe in his head while he was visiting the Spice Islands. Perez had received his sentry orders on October 25th, a date that was current in the Philippines, but in Mexico was still 24 hours in the future. 2 months later, remember, it took a long time to go from point A to point B. 2 months later, a ship arrived from the Philippines with the news that Manila's governor had, in fact, been assassinated, and one of the passengers testified that they had seen Gil Perez in Manila at the time. He was released, and he was sent back to Manila on the next ship. How did they do that? What happened? How was he teleported? 9,000 miles on the date of October 24th, 1593. If it raises the hair on the back of your neck. Yes. We don't often have the answers to a lot of questions that to this day still are unanswered. Fascinating speculation, isn't it? All right, let me give you this recipe for apple brined turkey breast. This is something that is unlike anything that you will have tried, and the flavor permeates the meat in a very, very delicate way. This is what you're going to need. You're going to need 3 quarts of apple juice or apple cider. You're going to need 2 cups of kosher salt, 2 cups of kosher salt, 1/2 cup of honey, 1/2 cup of honey, 1/2 cup of granulated sugar, 1/2 cup of packed brown sugar, and you need 2 whole bone-in turkey breasts, about 6 pounds each. If you just want to fix one, just use one and cut the recipe in half. You're going to need 2 large carrots. You want them unpeeled. You just chop them coarsely. 1 onion, unpeeled, quartered. 9 tablespoons of unsalted butter. That should be at room temperature. 1/4 cup of your favorite oil. And you may need to use a little extra for brushing the turkey. You're going to need 1 can of chicken broth, 1/2 cup of dry white wine, and 1 tablespoon of fresh lemon juice. And I recommend the fresh, not the bottled. So this is what you need to have. You need an extra large, non-reactive pot, which means you want to have a ceramic-lined pot, or if you have a big glass container, needs to be about 3 inches taller and 3 inches wider than your turkey breast. You want to put the juice, 3 quarts of water, salt, honey, and your sugars. You mix all that in with the apple juice. And then you put it over medium-high heat, bring it to a boil, stirring to completely dissolve the salt. And then you remove it from the heat, and then you let it cool. Now, what you do is you take your turkey breasts, you pat them dry with paper towels, and you immerse them completely in the brine in the pot, and you can put either a cap on it or put a small plate on top of the turkey to make sure that the meat stays submerged in it. Now, what you might want to do, and I haven't tried this, but it was suggested, you might want to use a large plastic bag inside of a container. That'll make it easier for the turkey to be lifted out. But use your own inventiveness. You want to cover it, and you want to refrigerate it anywhere for 12 to 24 hours, and this is a perfect time to start it. You want to move it around occasionally. You're going to, when you're ready to start cooking it, you want to drain it. You throw out all of the brine. You're going to cover your turkey with cold water and let it stand at room temperature, and you turn it a couple of times for 2 hours. You drain whatever moisture comes out from that, pat the turkey dry, trim the excess skin from the turkey. Preheat your oven to 325 degrees. Place your carrots and onion in a large roasting pan. Put 1.5 tablespoons of butter over the skin of each breast. Brush your rack with oil. Put your turkey in the roasting oven, and you're going to roast it for 30 minutes. Then in a pot, you pick your broth, chicken broth, your wine, lemon juice, and remaining 6 tablespoons of butter and 1/4 cup of oil. You heat it over low heat until the butter's melted. And after the turkey's roasted for 30 minutes, you baste it with some of the broth mixture and then turn your pan from front to back. Roast your turkey, basting with a broth mixture and the juices in the pan and rotating the pan every 30 minutes until the meat thermometer comes to 165 degrees. It's going to take you about 1.5 hours total. And if it's browning too quickly, just cover it with foil. Let it rest for about 10 minutes before you carve. And it's just going to be wonderful. You do want to keep it warm. But you can use the broth for the dressing or anything else you like. It really is a wonderful recipe. And yes, having a container might be a challenge for you, but there's a lot of options to work with. Just remember, you don't want it metal. You want to have it glass, ceramic, or big crock. This is Donna Sebo. We're out of time. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Have a magnificent day or evening wherever you are. God bless. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.